Good morning. My name is Catherine Flynn, and I'm a Boston Book Festival board member, proudly. And this is our 15th year of the festival. Welcome to Fictions of Class, Fictions of Place. I support the BBF because for 14 of the 15 years, I only missed 1 year when I had a baby, I have been coming to this festival to see amazing authors, to be in the beautiful spaces that we have in this city, and to experience the cultural life of the city with many other people together in one room. I want to make sure that the BBF can continue to provide this incredible programming for Boston. And in order to do that, we need donations. So I ask you to go online and donate or to visit the BBF tent in front of the public library and donate there today. Thank you, and now I'm going to turn it over to novelist and Bostonian Jennifer Haig.
It is thrilling to be here today with my friends Rick Russo and Andre Debuse. I have known these guys for a long time. And I view this event as like taking them to the dog park and letting them off leash. So I'm going to do my best with these two, but they are not easily controlled, I will tell you.
Lift our legs here.
Anything could happen up here. I will say first that Somebody's Fool and Such Kindness are two of the finest novels in this or any year. And it is thrilling to be able to talk with them both today and to share this with you. So I'm going to introduce them very briefly. They really need not much introduction, but here goes. Andre Debuse III is the author of Such Kindness and 8 other books, including the bestsellers Townie, a memoir, and The House of Sand and Fog, a National Book Award finalist in fiction, and an Oprah's Book Club selection. He lives in Newburyport, Mass. Richard Russo, yes, first. Richard Russo is the author of 10 novels, most recently Somebody's Fool, 2 collections of stories, and the memoir Elsewhere. In 2002, he received the Pulitzer Prize for Empire Falls, and in 2023, his novel Straight Man was adapted into the television series Lucky Hank. He lives in Portland, Maine. Welcome, Rick Russo. Okay, so the title of this panel, which I dreamed up myself, by the way, is Fictions of Class, Fictions of Place. And the title is meaningful for several reasons. In every one of the novels and short stories by these two guys, there is a palpable sense of place and a very fine awareness of class that is not universal in literary fiction. To me, that means their characters' lives are grounded in the material realities of life. That is to say, where and how these people live are dictated by what is financially possible. And the way they see themselves and the world is profoundly shaped by those ideas about what is possible. This is meaningful to me because I consider myself also kind of a working class writer. I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, coal mining country, and I write a lot about people who work with their hands. And when I started out as a novelist, it was startling to me to realize that a lot of editors find it hard to believe that people who work with their hands are capable of complex thought. That was a revolutionary idea when I started writing about my town of Bakerton, Pennsylvania. As I look around the literary landscape, I see lots and lots of novels about upper middle class people. Some of them are novels I really admire and appreciate. But I will say, a few years ago, there was a very highly regarded literary novel, got wonderful reviews, about some 20-something friends who live in New York City in fantastic apartments that they could not possibly afford doing the kinds of jobs they're doing in the novel. And not one reviewer was bothered by this. Yeah. And for a reader like me, that rendered the whole project impossible to enter into. I could not suspend my disbelief. That could never happen in a Russo or Debussy novel. It simply would not, because these are guys who pay attention to the realities of people's lives. So thanks to them both for that. It's something I, as a reader, have always appreciated. I'm going to begin with a question for Andre, but as you will quickly see, these guys are going to interrupt each other. As long as there's no barking and no biting, it's fine. But let's just say this is Andre's question. Okay, so your new novel, Such Kindness, focuses on a man who, until a few years ago, was a builder. He was a man who worked hard, took pride in his work, and until he fell off a roof and broke his back, his work was his identity. So, Tom, your character has multiple surgeries, he gets hooked on painkillers, as will happen, and when we meet him on page one, he's in a pretty desperate situation. So I just want you to talk about where the initial spark for this novel came from. What started you on this?
Physical pain, I would say. First of all, it's a real honor to be interviewed by the great Jennifer Haig, I would just like to say. For years, I grew up, let me compress. Rick, interrupt me whenever you would like. I grew up the son of a single mom living in first world poverty in the Merrimack Valley in Milltowns. And I grew up with a mom who either was going to pay the rent on time or we'd have heat, who was either going to put gas in the car to go to work or we'd get groceries, not all at the same time. So that scarcity, that sense of scarcity has never left my psyche. Even though as an adult, I've lived an abundant, thank God, life for my kids. So what started, Jennifer, was curiosity and terror. I was a self-employed carpenter for years. Early on in my writing life, I decided I don't want to get a real job, one that might make money and impress people when I said what I did for a living, maybe buy me a house. So I cleaned toilets. I worked in bars. I worked in halfway houses, mainly because it was overnight shifts and I write in the morning. And I was always broke, and then throughout my 30s, I was a self-employed carpenter, an adjunct writing teacher, a member of the Migrant Farm Workers of Academia. But my writing life finally took off after 20 years, and I became a professor. But before that, I worked jobs where you always broke a sweat, and if you didn't go to work, you didn't get paid. So you go to work hurt. You go to work with the flu, because you got to put in your shift. So I was haunted by a question one day, which is, what if I was still self-employed carpenter? I'm 64 years old, and everything hurts when I get up for like 3 hours. And what if I got hurt? And what if I still have this mortgage, and I've got kids to take care of? What then? And that's where Tom came from.
Okay, so I'm going to give one to Rick now. Again, feel free to interrupt. Rick, one thing you and I have in common is that we have repeatedly returned to this fictional landscape that we created and have written about before. For me, it's this fictionalized coal mining town in Pennsylvania called Bakerton, which is very much modeled on the town where I grew up. For Rick, it is this fictional town in upstate New York, North Bath. So you're writing about, in some instances, characters you conceived of years ago, and then some new characters who are connected to those older characters. So I'm going to ask you the question I have often asked myself. What is it that keeps drawing you back to this same fictional town?
How did you answer it?
I was going to steal it.
That's great.
I want to go back to something that I will answer that, but I wanted to go back to something that you asked Andre. I wanted to ask you too. You got a late start as a writer. I did too. Mm-hmm. And that sense of being from a part of the world where nobody necessarily would care about anything that you had to say, that held me back. That was one of the things that held me back. And I was wondering if it held you back, because it's strange. I didn't go the carpenter route. Strange as it may seem to you, I did not go the carpenter route to writing. Rather, I was doing a PhD. It seemed at the beginning that I was doing it because I wanted to, but then it became more apparent that it was something that my mother wanted me to do, and she had great hopes and plans for my future. And that's what I was doing, and I did. I went all the way through a PhD in American literature before I decided to cross the hall to creative writing and maybe write a story. Mm. And one of the things that held me back, despite the fact that my favorite writers were Dickens and Twain, and would have taught me that you don't need an academic pedigree to be a writer, nevertheless, to my mind, people would not be interested in anything that I had to say about my life experience or more importantly, the place that I was from and the people that I was only just beginning to acknowledge how much I loved. And so the answer to your question, I think, of why I keep going back to North Bath through three books now, and this will be the end. But
you said that last time.
Yeah, come on. I don't buy it.
But I will apologize for lying later when I write a fourth one. But for now, it seems like the end. But the reason that I keep going back, I think, was that it took me so bloody long. That was the last thing that I learned about writing was who I was, which is another way of saying who and what do I love. Once I figured that out, that came last. Mm. And you would think it would come first because it doesn't take, you know, you don't have to have a massive brain to come to the conclusion of who and what you love. But it took me forever. Mm. And that's why I keep going back to these places that, having finally learned at age, like around age 30, after studying literature for all those years, finally at around that time, I looked at myself in the mirror and said, here's who I love. Mm. And here's what I love and who I love. And strangely enough, it was the place that I grew up.
Oh, that's wonderfully well said, Rick. You know, when I started writing, I guess I was an undergrad when I started trying to write stories. And the first stories I wrote were always first-person male narrators from other places, often mm-hmm. from places I'd never been, because I had internalized the lesson that that's who writes literature.
Sure.
And so being a working-class person from rural America, from a dying coal town, with a double whammy of being female, I never imagined that the world as I knew it was a worthy subject for literature. And I'll tell you what changed it for me. I had a wonderful teacher. My first creative writing teacher was a writer named Robert Olmsted. And he picked up on this really quickly. And he gave me the first book by Jane Ann Phillips, who was, very young woman, from West Virginia, from my part of the world. And she wrote about people and landscapes that I recognized. And that really peeled back the sky for me. Like, you can do that? That's literature? You're allowed to do that, really? And it radically changed the way I thought about writing and the way I thought about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the most useful lesson a teacher of creative writing has ever given me. And maybe it's the only one I needed.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, a good read. You know, for me, it was Brees D.J. Pancake, which ironically, if you don't know the stories of Brees D.J. Pancake, please get them. He killed himself in his 20s, and his mom, just the same story with Kennedy O'Toole, brought the manuscript around. It got published. It's a beautiful collection. It was handed to me by a dear friend when I was just starting to write. I had a different situation because my father was a beautiful writer,
yeah.
But I grew up with a single mom in a different house. I think what kept me from writing was my brother was an artist, and I think a lot of people do this. He was a guitarist and a painter, and he was birthdays, he got guitar strings, canvases, I got underwear, right? So I said, well, he's an artist, I must be something else, I don't know, something else. But I started reading Pancake, and I'd been reading Updike, and I was writing from the point of view of kids I didn't even know. I was writing from the point of view of people who went to camp in the summer and, you know, had two parents growing up. What the hell was I doing? And then I read these beautiful, stark, poetic stories by Brees D.J. Pancake about coal mining country. And I'm not from coal mining country, as Jennifer is, but I'm from Milltown country. And so then I put all that bullshit I was writing away, and I wrote from the point of view of an inmate on a date with a woman for the first time after doing 7 years. And I based them on one of my best friends who was killed at 25, and then I found my way in.
And you know, the exact opposite can happen too, in that you can be slowed down in becoming a writer by writers that you love and who you would like to be,
right,
but will never be if you live to be 200.
Right.
And for me, that writer was Ross McDonald. I read all those Archer mysteries when I was in graduate school. I was studying literature in my PhD program, but in my spare time, I was reading all those Ross McDonald books, and of course, went back and read all the tough guy detectives, Raymond Chandler, and all of those. But those Ross McDonald books were wonderful, and there were certain aspects of those books that that would be useful to me, because there was a lot of class in his novels. But I wanted to write about being a tough guy. I wanted to write about dames. I wanted to write about California. I wanted to write everything that I loved about his work and still admire. I still think, when I look back at it now, genuflecting before that particular altar, I'm sure, held me back. So finding the right book can help you get there. Finding the wrong one can really
that's great.
The wrong ones can really hold you back.
Wow.
Because that's what I thought I would need to be, as we were talking about earlier.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You know, this is the thing I've learned as a teacher of creative writing. There are really only two things you can do for students. One is to teach them the difference between a good sentence and a bad sentence. And the other is to put just the right book in their hands at just the right time.
Yeah.
And that's not so easily done. That there's there's some art to that. You have to really know your students in order to do that. But if you can do those two things, if your student is talented and driven, they'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
They will do it. They will be
writers. And it's difficult. It's difficult under any circumstances. But one of the things, you're right, putting the right book in the right student's hands. The problem is that some of the teaching that I do now is in these circumstances where you have a group of very talented writers, but you only have them for like a week or 10 days.
Conferences, yep.
And it's very difficult because it takes that time not only to establish trust, but it takes that time to know that student, that writer, over a semester or two semesters before, at exactly the right time, which often involves, you know, a beer in the hand after class, to say, here's the book.
Yeah.
But it's tough to do that without the necessary time to really get to know these people that you're teaching.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. The other thing that I think is really important, and I know both of you are of the same religion here, that I really believe that writing is revision. It is, and that is one of the hardest things impart to emerging writers who feel like, oh my God, I got through the story once. You mean to tell me I got to do it again? You know?
305 times.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is where all the art is, for sure. Okay, so back to questions.
Can I just jump in on a...
Oh, yeah,
there's a wonderful line about it from the writer Paul Engle, who ran the writer's workshop in Iowa for years. He said, oh, writing is rewriting what you've already rewritten. Mm. It's great.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so... back to your character, Tom. One thing the book does frighteningly well is dramatize this kind of cascade failure that happens in Tom's life. How one thing goes wrong,
yeah,
and another thing goes wrong. He can't work because he got injured working. Because he isn't working, he can't pay his car registration, so his car gets towed. He tries to get money by selling his tools, but someone breaks into his house and steals his tools. And so, individually, these are all things that could happen to anyone.
Right.
But if you're a middle-class person, any one of these things is not catastrophic. You're like, okay, I didn't get my car registered, my car got towed. Oh, well, I'll whip out my credit card, I'll get my car back. It's a bad day, but so what? But the thing that you really see in your novel is that how... It leads to this kind of death spiral in a person's life if you cannot whip out the credit card and pay to get your car back,
right.
more mayhem ensues.
Right.
So anybody who's ever been poor will recognize this phenomenon, this kind of inexorability of things going wrong. Can you talk about that, about how you got that on the page?
Yeah, you know, I think writers write from their terror and their fears and their desires and their, you know, all of that. For me, it's how I grew up. And you know, we were better off than a lot of my friends, you know, who also were afflicted with addictions and violence and, you know, less money than my mother had. And so let me back up. I worked in corrections. I wasn't a correctional officer. I was a counselor in a halfway house for convicted adult felons out of Canyon City Penitentiary, maximum security pen in Colorado in my 20s. And I got in trouble, and our job was, you know, just to, these guys were on pre-parole, they'd earned it, they'd all done terrible things, they'd done their time. And I was a 22-year-old kid who had power over men my father's age, and they had to do what I said. And the director pulled me in, he says, hey, it's Andre Dubas, hey Dubas, we got a problem with you. I said, what? What's the problem? The inmates like you too much. Well, is that bad? He said, you don't want them to like you. You want them to respect you. And I realized what was going on. I identified far more with the inmates than I did with my college-educated white colleagues, who one of them I really liked. We'd go out for beers after work, and he would call them criminals and bad guys. I said, what the hell are you talking about? Bad guys. Tom Waits. Here's a line from Tom Waits. There is no devil. There's just God when he's drunk. I said, you know there's just...
I love that you just said that in church, by the way.
You understand, right? Drink less. forgive me if that's blasphemy. But I guess what I'm trying to say is I think that, look, there but for the grace of God, go every single one of us. We're all just an injury away from losing a job. Or, you know, if we're estranged from our family, maybe they don't have any money. We could all be where this character is like that. And I want to point out something else that I read while writing the novel. And this is a frightening statistic. Do you know that something between 75 and 80% of American families have no more than $400 in the bank in case of an emergency? $400. That's $400 my mother never had. She never had $40. So I identify with that, and it just comes from what I know. One thing happens, and then another, and then another. And it is why I do not judge people who commit crimes. I judge violence. I judge bad behavior. I don't judge them, and I never will.
So here's a question for Rick. So you've written three of these full novels mm-hmm. now, right? So I think of them as the full novels, and I kind of read them all as they came out. So, you know, there was Nobody's Fool, Everybody's Fool, and now Somebody's Fool. Each one of these books came out at a distinctly different moment, and I was reading this new one. I was struck by this feeling that this book could not have been written in a different time. It is very much a book of its moment.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. As a matter of fact, I had begun, there was all that time, there was almost two decades or something, no, over a decade between Nobody's Fool and Somebody's, because I hadn't intended to do that. But once I did Somebody's and realized I could have so much fun with my old man, who was the character was based on, Sully was based on, I could go back and have fun with these people, and they were still alive, and they would still be all kinds of fun to be around and have a ball. Then I went to Somebody's Fool very quickly. I began it very quickly. It was just a very few years. The reason that it took a while to come out was that between Everybody's Fool and Somebody's Fool, George Floyd was murdered. And I had, in the previous book, one of the two protagonists of the previous book, Doug Raymer, had this relationship with this black police officer, Charisse. And I knew he was going to be a major character in the third book. But after Floyd's murder, it seemed to me that the book that I was intending to write could no longer be written. There had to be, number one, there couldn't be a book full of just good cops, because both Raymer and Charisse were good, not only good cops, but decent human beings.
Right.
And I could not fail to acknowledge the existence of bad cops anymore, not after what had happened. So there had to be,
Delgado.
And then, so Delgado is born out of that. But the other thing that happened, of course, was that in Everybody's Fool, you never had the sense between Raymer and Charisse, you never had the sense that their relationship between an attractive young black police officer and Raymer, who is, I say in the book, seems to have a common ancestor with the Pillsbury Doughboy. there was never a sense in that book that the world might be out to get them. Mm. You know, their romance was simply something that was taking place on its own terms. After Floyd's murder, it seemed to me that I had to come to terms with the fact that if we were looking at their relationship now, it had to come to terms with the fact that if their relationship resulted in a child, that child would be born black and would be treated black,
right,
by the world.
Right.
That was something that Charisse already knew, but it's not something that Raymer would have given a single thought to. And that was, and that changed the entire arc of the Raymer story for the first time, because my books have all been about class. For the first time, race had to enter the story front and center, take center stage. And it turned out to be the best thing that could have happened for the book, in a way, because it got me to treat something. It was new territory for me, which is always exciting. But it also offered me the opportunity to put into that book the other big love story in the book is not Charisse and Raymer, it's Raymer and Jerome.
Yeah.
Who can, Jerome, who
Charisse's
can...
Charisse's brother.
Charisse's brother. Yeah. Charisse's brother, Jerome, now becomes the person who has to educate, mm-hmm, who has to educate Raymer to what he does, does not
and
understand.
Those scenes are both heartbreaking and comic.
Yeah,
he's a fantastic hero. Yeah. Jerome is the star of this Bond.
I absolutely
Jerome Bond.
Yeah. So much. Yeah, the name is Bond. Jerome Bond.
Well, you know, this leads me to something I was wondering about, and this is sort of a writerly question. As I was reading this latest of the three full books, it occurred to me that because I had read the earlier two, I brought a whole understanding of North Bath to this text. But many of your readers will not have read those first two books.
Mm-hmm.
And so this book has to, and absolutely does, stand on its own as a novel. My question to you, Rick, is how do you even do that? Because there's such a complex history, and it's a large cast of characters. How do you convey that in such a way that it feels complete all by itself?
It was more of a problem in this third book than it's been in between the first two. And people have asked me, should I read the first two before reading the third one? And I always say, well, yeah, if you can, because they do build, I think.
They really build.
Yeah.
But also because if you've read the second book, there's a mystery in the third one about a man, about a corpse that's found hanging in the old Sans Souci, this former resort. That's been a feature in the first two books. So if you don't know the first two books, you're not quite sure what the Sans Souci is, and you don't want to go back and reprogram all that early history. But also because there's a mystery in the third book about who is the corpse. That's what Raymer and Charisse are trying to figure out, is who's the corpse hanging from the ballroom of the Sans Souci. Well, if you've read the second book, you have a better chance of figuring out who that is.
Right.
If you read the third book, you have a slim chance.
Right. You're not going to figure it out.
You're just
reading the third book.
No, you're not going to figure it out.
Absolutely enjoy it.
So there is a sense, whenever you don't know something, It's not that you're not going to, it's not that you're not going to have any enjoyment, but you're not going to have maybe the same depth of enjoyment where your heart kind of flutters and you think, oh God, you know, that's, oh God, no, that's who it is. You know, you're
but
not going
to. It's the same kind of joy that you get when you know someone for decades.
Yes.
You're bringing all that history to this dinner conversation and yeah.
Yeah.
So buy it as a set, all three.
You know, This novel, Rick, opens with kind of an unusual situation where the town of North Bath has basically voted itself out of existence. This town is merging with the town next door, and North Bath is going to cease to exist. Reading this, I had such a feeling of recognition because, true story, this little coal mining town I grew up in Pennsylvania, Barnesboro, did the same thing.
Really?
Yes. In the year 2000... I had already moved away from this town. I was long gone. But the coal mines in western Pennsylvania had so suffered that the towns had lost two-thirds of their population. They'd lost all their tax base. These towns were destitute. They really didn't have revenue to cover basic services like picking up the trash. So the town council effectively voted itself out of existence. They voted to merge with the town next door. The town I grew up in is not on a map anymore.
Mm-hmm.
If you Google Barnesboro, Pennsylvania, Google will helpfully redirect you to Northern Cambria, Pennsylvania, what the amalgamation is now called.
Wow.
So I had seen that in life, but I had never seen it in literature until I read this book.
Well, I think it's the story of all three of our lives, except it's happened in, I think, slightly different ways. What we're talking about is a particular legal thing that can happen when, in the case of my North Bath, is that they've basically been running on economic fumes forever. They've been on kind of a morphine drip, and this other luckier town, I mean the lucky town, the springs have continued to percolate up in North Bath. Their springs ran dry and their economy ran dry, and so finally there was nothing else to do but give up the ghost. And Schuyler Spring comes in and gobbles them up. What usually happens, I think, is it's the same thing under a different rubric as what's happened to some place like Newburyport,
mm-hmm.
where the town doesn't go away, but it gets bought up by...
It's gentrified.
It gets gentrified by
and the
people
who live there
with
gotta
a whole
move.
With a whole shitload of money,
right.
and now the people who used to live there have to find someplace else to live.
Right.
The town is still there, but it's nothing that we who live in places like that would recognize. I mean, I live in Portland, Maine right now, and my wife and I have lived there for 10 years or so, and it's very difficult for us to recognize what we loved about Portland, Maine, for the simple reason that so much money, it's just money on the move. And trust me, it is unstoppable when that happens. And it's happening everywhere. If we right now wanted to live in a place like Portland, the Portland that we moved to, we would have to move to Biddeford. And it wouldn't be that much longer before that
right.
place where all the artists and the writers and the filmmakers and the people who used to make Portland an interesting place to live, they've all had to move to Biddeford or someplace like that. And it's only a matter of time before Biddeford becomes the same thing.
Yeah.
Right. So it's just money on the move.
Completely. And you know, this kind of specter of gentrification, it's really in the DNA of your novel as well, because Tom was a builder,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he is the guy who is at the root of this kind of real estate generated economy that we all live in now, where real estate is crazy inflated kind of all over New England, but certainly in the community Tom is living in. And so I thought about that a lot, you know, that he's part of what got the ball rolling on gentrification in a way, and he's one of the people left behind.
But he was also aspiring to be one of those people. You know, his marriage doesn't make it through. His house gets repossessed. He also, as you know, signed the papers for an adjustable rate mortgage, and then 2008 happened, and then he can't pay his monthly mortgage, and he's working harder, and that's why he falls off the roof, etc. But he and his wife had some fault lines in their marriage already. She grew up, he calls her an abundist, which is a word he made up, meaning she grew up in abundance. She wasn't rich, but she grew up on the grounds of a private high school. Her parents were happily married. She had a beautiful home on the grounds. She, you know, just she grew up pampered and loved, and it a beautiful childhood. He grew up the son of a teenage mother whose father died when Tom and his little brother were young. Mom had a string of boyfriends, and so he calls himself and the people he lives with in Section 8 housing scarcitists, people who grew up in scarcity. And one of the things that struck me writing about Tom in that novel is how poignantly, feverishly, deeply we all need to feel useful. And those of us who grew up in scarcity and get moved out by the abundance, by the abundists, let me just back up. I try not to ever be didactic or pedantic with fiction, but I do know that my own view of this culture is all through that book. I am haunted by how capitalism has killed relationships. And I'm not a communist, but I'm also not a rabid capitalist. This is a culture that breaks its citizens down into winners or losers. And it's a racist patriarchy. So who are the winners? Well, rich, white, straight men. And who are the losers? Well, the rest of you bastards. and so all of that is in there. And of course, Tom begins in a very bitter place, but he goes somewhere quite different, which surprised me, and which is beautiful.
Well, it is completely surprising to the reader, too, because when you start reading this novel and you see the dire straits this man is living in, it seems impossible that there is a way out of this, and a credible way out of this. You know, it's not like he wins the lottery and it's all better. It's not that kind of way out. Right. But there is a way out, and it is an absolutely redemptive kind of ending.
My character can't afford a cell phone either. He doesn't have one anymore.
Well, you know, first meeting Tom in the novel, I thought a lot about your memoir, Townie. Because it seemed to me that a lot of the guys we meet as young men in Townie are future Toms, potentially future Toms. Mm. And so I wonder if, Andre, you could talk about the difference for you in writing memoir versus writing a novel, even though it's in some of the same psychic territory and the same geography, but it's a different animal. So I wish you could talk about that.
Oh, man. You know, what I love about writing novels is it's a complete blank slate. Right, you got to, as you both know so beautifully, you've got to come up with all of it. With memoir or personal essay, you know what happened. You're trying to capture what happened. One of the most helpful lines of advice about writing stories came from a filmmaker, Mike Nichols, the great Mike Nichols. Mm-hmm. I saw him interviewed years ago, and the interviewer said, "What's the question the storyteller must ask before writing stories, sir?" He said, "Well, it's not what the newspaper reporter asks." So if you're a reporter, of course, your central question is, you know, all the W's, what happened, when, where, who? He said, but that's not what the storyteller's question is. The storyteller's question is not what happened, but what's it like, what's it really like to be in this thing that's happened? And so for me, writing that memoir, Townie, you know, there was nothing that I didn't remember having happened, although writing got me to areas that brought me more clarity. So I didn't have to come up with the events of what happened. I was just able to just try to capture what it was really like from my subjective point of view of what happened. What's it like to live in a mill town? What's it like to live with a single mom with no money? What's it like to be beaten all the time because you're a small kid who wears glasses and used adverbs in daily speech until I stopped doing that shit? No more, not necessarily. No, no. I started to say, whatever. And so the difference for me is, let's go, so such kindness, it is the same territory. And I want to just go back to what we were talking about earlier about writing about place. For years, I didn't write about the Merrimack Valley because I freaking hated it. I had a horribly painful, sad childhood there, as did my siblings. I associated it with nothing but wounds. And then somehow I fall in love with a woman from there, and I'm living there again. And it was such the right thing to do, to go back to the place of the wound. However, in Newburyport 40 years ago, when my single mom moved us there in 1971, it was a tough, hard to believe if you didn't, I've even seen pictures, tough, ugly, abandoned waterfront town. Bad behavior everywhere. Drunks would stumble home and, you know, twice opened the door to our rented house with no locks and piss on the hallway floorboards. You know, there's more darkness I won't drag you through. And the truth is, and now it's a gentrified, cute little town, almost a little too cute for me, where I raised my kids. And our three kids are grown now, but the question is, did I do them a disservice to raise them in such a cute little town? I kind of miss the drunks and the weeds and the broken glass, dude.
Well, you know, in a panel like this, you often zero in on the commonalities between the books you're talking about. And those are very obvious in the case of these two. But there's also one really profound difference, I think, between these two novels that I'd like to talk about. And that has to do with this question of community. So in your novel, Rick, you know, North Bath is in a period of crisis, and it is losing its identity and is getting swallowed up by its wealthier neighbor. But among your characters, there is a very palpable feeling of community still, that these people recognize each other. They know each other's histories. They gossip about each other. There is connective tissue between them. And in your book, Andre, Tom is an island. He is a guy without community. And so I'd like to hear both of you talk about that. Maybe, Rick, you first, talking about this idea of community among these characters.
Well, in the North Bath books, just so much of that place is memory, is my memory of returning to upstate New York after when I went off to college. I went off to the University of Arizona, and that was my mother's plan, to get us as far away from Gloversville, New York as possible. But I would go home in the summers, and that was when I actually got to know my father, because he was kind of on the periphery of my life when I was growing up. I never got to know him very well. And when I got back there during the summer, and I was old enough then at age 18 to occupy the bar stool next to his, I got to know him and we became close. But I got to know not only him, I got to know his whole coterie of friends. And most of his friends are working class guys who were, like my father, rode hard and put up wet. And, you know, a lot of them did really... Their bodies were already breaking down at age 40, 45, 50, like Tom. You know, they've been doing this tough work. And what I loved about them was, number one, they had such a wonderful sense of humor. They didn't feel sorry for themselves in the least. And because it was that time, they also took great pride in the work that they were doing, even though it was the work that we were talking about earlier, the kind of work that you do with your hands that not everybody respects in this world. And back then, you could still do it and have respect. And I still make a living. Yeah, and I still remember working with my father one year on a new exit in Albany, on the Albany Thruway. It was a ramp that we built that summer. And he and I could never drive past that without just kind of looking at each other. Thing, you know, that one summer, we built that. And I think working people, my father and his friends, none of them had an awful lot of money, but they did have certain values. They took pride in the work that they did, and they were there for each other. When, you know, nobody had an awful lot of money, but there was usually one of them that could, if somebody was in trouble, could. And I always found that just... I found it fascinating, because I think that the life that that my mother had in mind for me, God love her, If it hadn't been for her, I wouldn't have become educated. I wouldn't have become a writer. I wouldn't, all the things in my life that I cherish so much right now would not have happened if my mother hadn't emphasized certain things that I went ahead and did. But I think that because she herself grew up strapped, had always imagined an abundant life.
Yeah.
And certainly wanted that for me. But the world that I'm writing about in these fool books is not so much my world as my father's world. And a world that mm-hmm. for guys like him doesn't exist anymore, because so many of those jobs either got lost to automation or to globalism or whatever. My wife and I, when I was on book tour, we took a ride along Route 29. I had an event in Saratoga Springs, which is Schuyler Springs in my novel, and we took along Route 29 to Gloversville, where I grew up. Along Route 29, my father and I used to do that all the time, and there was a series of roadhouses along the way, and we would stop at all of them, but we were coming from Saratoga Springs, where he could afford to visit. No way in the world you could afford to live there, but one or two Saturdays during racing season, we could go up there. And he used those roadhouses on the way home, where we would stop and have a beer or two. By the time he got home, he was happy to be there. Mm-hmm. One roadhouse at a time. And by the time he got there, he was saying, this isn't so bad, you know? And that's the world that I'm writing about, and I've been writing about it a long time because I feel like I'm taking a snapshot, really. That's a historical snapshot. And when we made that drive along Route 29, heading to Gloversville, I just looked at those places and these were places, half of them had closed down and the other half were hanging by a thread. And what my father would have said, you mean to tell me that there's going to be a day when you can't make a living selling cold, cheap beer to working men?
Right. Right.
That was a long answer.
No, I love what you said, though, because those novels are capturing a time that is no longer.
Yeah.
That is fading. You know, there's a wonderful book I highly recommend. I read it after finishing writing my novel, Such Kindness. It's by Matthew Desmond, Poverty by America.
Yeah.
It's an incredible book.
This is the writer of Evicted that some of you may have read.
Won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction.
Marvelous writer.
He's a sociologist out of Princeton, and he considers himself a poverty abolitionist, which I think is a beautiful phrase. Mm. And what he argues in this book, he said, when you drive by, you know, these poor homeless people on the street, try to not do what we do, which is, gee, what kind of poor choices did she make?
Yeah, yeah.
He said, instead, ask yourself, how am I benefiting from her poverty? And the truth is, we benefit materially in all sorts of ways. So you asked about community and lack of it. In my novel, poverty isolates. And I'm sure there are many people in this church who know that firsthand. When you're poor, nobody wants anything to do with you. You're the loser. Back off. And in fact, I think people fear it's contagious.
Yes.
Like, I'm not, come on, man, things are going good. I'm not hanging out with you. I have a job, and my wife hasn't left me yet, and my car starts up, usually. So, no, sorry, buddy, go get some help. I wasn't trying to make Tom isolated, but just trying to be him in Section 8 housing, which he calls the 8. Everybody had disappeared. Nobody wants to be with the guy on the bottom. And it's a sad statement about how we can be in the world. But there you go.
Okay, well, we have a little time for some questions from the audience. There are two microphones set up in the center aisle. So if you have a question, by all means, come up to the mic and ask it. We're eager to hear.
Question, comment. There's a nice person right there.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
So my question is, when you're revising, how do you know when you're done with a revision without,
a
like, an editor?
Yeah.
Great question.
After you.
Well, number one, I don't expect to be finished revising for at least 15 or 16 or 17 drafts. Yeah. That's the first thing. But I think I begin to be suspicious of revision under two circumstances, one of which is that revision 18 after 17, revision 18 actually makes it worse, that's not a good sign.
Right.
And the other is that sometimes you can revise if you become... When I first started writing, I would write all the way through the first draft, and then I'd go back and start again. I've become so compulsive about revising that now I revise much earlier. And I've come to understand that there are times when I'm compulsively revising something in the first part of a book, that what I'm really doing is staving off the fact that I haven't figured out quite what the next thing is yet.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can
let's polish this a little
more.
That's
right. What my daughter Kate calls polishing a turd.
Yeah.
So that's what it is. That's what it is for me.
Jennifer, what would you say?
Well, you know, I can see very clearly when I'm at the end of the revision process. It's when I spend the whole day putting in commas that I took out yesterday.
Yeah.
And it's the same damn commas.
Yeah.
And that's when somebody needs to just tear it out of my hands because I'm finished.
When our kids were little, I come home on Friday and we'd play games and everything, and then they're teenagers and they're not home on Friday, and I can't sleep till they're all back home and in bed on Sunday night. And that's what it feels like to me when it's done. I don't feel like they're out in the rain anymore. I feel like they're all tucked in, and then I move on to the next story.
Mm, I like that.
Yeah. I like that a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, boy, lower that mic for that woman.
Thank you. First, I want to say it's really great, Mr. Russo, to meet another upstate New York person. I'm from Fonda, so...
No kidding.
Yeah, yep. My friend just pointed out this sweater I got in Gloversville. But anyway, I was wondering, like, how has your writing changed now that you're kind of, like, in, you know, like, Schuyler Springs? Like, the worlds that you live in are, like... the swanky versions of the world, and how has that, like, changed your writing, and, like, when did you let people from home read it, et cetera?
Well, I've had an interesting relationship with upstate New York, having written about it for my entire career is spent up there in one or two novels that, I mean, there's one that's set on Cape Cod, but it's still filtered through the eyes of someone like me. These are three scholarship kids, one set on Cape Cod. But I've been writing about upstate New York this whole time. And my experience has been that people in Gloversville, despite the fact that I have not been writing Chamber of Commerce portraits of upstate New York.
Riveting.
Yeah. Despite the fact that I haven't been doing that, but my experience is that people like to be noticed. They like their lives. They like for the sense that somebody out there is paying attention to them when it seems like the whole world isn't. And so I've been given a lot of love these books from upstate New York, because I think people have felt noticed, and also because I've given these various places fictional names, Mohawk, North Bath, all of that, which gives people time, the ability to kind of turn around and say, not me, but people like me, that sort of thing. The one time I got blowback was from my memoir, where I called Gloversville, Gloversville. And there was considerable blowback from that, because they felt like they didn't have that room to turn around. I was naming things by their real world names, and being very, very critical of the tanneries and the glove shops that were poisoning the town that I grew up in, and I got a lot of blowback from that. So strangely enough, the one time that I called Gloversville, Gloversville, there was considerable blowback from that. Other times, people have lavished me with far more affection than I ever would have dreamed, and it's a dangerous it's not so dangerous for a fiction writer. That's kind of what we do. But it's dangerous in the sense that when what am I trying to say here? The dynamic of it is dangerous in the sense that when people feel like someone else is noticing them, they respond, and they often respond in a very powerful way. And I think people in upstate New York, from places that I've been writing about all these years, have now felt for the last 12 years, 15 years, like they've been noticed by a politician, and they've responded favorably. I won't say anything more than that.
That's right.
I won't say any more than that.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Race and class is such a big lenses to look at everything. And I think in recent years, maybe like you pointed out with George Floyd, there's more people look more at race issues. Doesn't mean we're solving them, but we're looking at them more. Even if the Trump's focus on some working class issues, even though he didn't do anything about them, they're more noticed. But overall, class is not noticed, as you pointed out in the beginning, Jennifer. And Anthony Lucas, the author of Common Ground, called class the dirty little secret of American life.
That's right.
So how do you feel why class is not written about more in books and journalism and addressed in our lives?
Oh, let me jump in on that.
Yeah, would you? yeah.
So I believe this strongly, that in general, it has to do with the economics of publishing in the U.S. To have a career as an editor in American publishing, it's sort of a steep hill to climb because the entry-level jobs in publishing are so miserably underpaid that the only people who can get them and live that way have family support. So it selects for people from upper middle class or upper class backgrounds.
That's a great point.
Because if really you don't have help, there's no way you can live in New York City on what they pay you. Mm-hmm. So this selects for a certain kind of person becoming an editor. It's not anybody's fault, but it is a fact that we all gravitate towards stories that have characters we recognize, that reflect back to us a world we recognize. Then the book that we're looking at seems deeply true because it jibes with our experience. So these young editors coming up in New York who are from more privileged backgrounds very naturally respond to stories about people they recognize, people like them. And there's no evil intent here. It's a natural phenomenon. As readers, we all respond this way. But it explains why there is this bias toward admiring and publishing books that reflect the reality as you know it. So if somebody is writing a novel about a dying coal mining town in Appalachia, for example, it is the kind of story that leaves a lot of young editors scratching their heads because they just have no frame of reference for this place and these people. Again, there's no evil intent. It is a natural phenomenon. But because the economics of publishing are what they are, the people who end up being editors and publishing books are naturally responding to certain kinds of stories and not others. And I really think that is the root of it.
Do you think that we have turned a corner a little bit, at least? I mean, I wonder what a book like this, the incredible success of a book like Barbara Kingsolver's Demon Copperhead, I wonder if that would influence in any way. I mean, what we're talking about here is the fact that the characters that we write about in our books, none of them can afford to take unpaid internships, can they? That's what you do.
They can't afford to buy our books.
That's right. I maybe it's just the optimist in me, but I'd like to think that some of the books that are getting published now suggest that something. Maybe it's just that the editors coming out now are realizing that there at least is money to be, even if they don't understand this world, there's money to be made from more diverse stories. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being optimistic.
Oh, I think there's some truth in what you're saying, Rick, and especially. It's the same way Hollywood works. You know, once something has made money, there is a rush to replicate it. It doesn't matter what it is. If it was profitable, there is a rush to replicate it. So maybe that will happen with Demon Copperhead that won the Pulitzer this year. Where I do see a lot of reason for hope in the publishing world is this growing awareness of race. And compared to when I started publishing books 20 years ago, there is much better representation, editors of color, than there were then. There were almost none, even 20 years ago. And now there are many more. And it's, I think publishers really have had a come to Jesus moment about race. There is a dawning awareness that this lily white publishing industry it does not reflect America. This is not what America looks like. And there has been a real concerted effort to change that. So I got to give publishers credit for this. They really have done it. They don't just talk about it. They really have been hiring more editors of color. There are more books being published by writers of color. And that is absolutely reason for hope.
And agents, too. Agents. Yeah. I think agents are recognizing that same fact. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Hello. Thank you again for your time today. A question I had. When Richard was discussing John Updike, he mentioned his stories about people going to summer camps, and oftentimes Updike we think of preppies going on skiing trips, but at the same time, through his rabbit books, I think Updike made one of the great kind of portraits of a blue-collar town. Brewer, which was his fictionalized Reading, where he was born, I was born as well, and I find it to be an amazing portrait of a place. Do you feel like a kind of person who's from a working-class town, which is Updike, but is not necessarily a working class person, write convincingly and honestly about working class experiences in that kind of setting?
Yeah, it's absolutely possible. You know, this is something I believe strongly, that any writer is allowed to try to write any story. And if you're a really good observer, if you listen to people with an open heart, yes, that absolutely is possible. Writers can write about people entirely unlike themselves and do it well if they have this kind of humility and listening heart. That's what's required.
And profound empathy, curiosity, and compassion, and non-judgment. There's a one, Sarah Orne Jewett is the writer who said, write what you know. But E.L. Doctorow said, yeah, but how do you know what you know?
Yeah.
Let us stop on that note. Yeah. It's a great question. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We could sit here all day. It would
thank
be
you,
a
everybody. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, honey. That was great.
Books are for sale. Books are for sale at the rear of the church. We will be signing in the vestibule through those doors. So if you could just give us a little space to come down this center aisle to get back there, that would be great. Thank you so much.